Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Welcome back to Get Off My World. I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
And I'm Josh.
We are just three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and doing our best to love the new series as well. We are going to take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what we love and what we don't love about our favorite show. Round one, Temporal Grace. We always start the program with things that we love about Doctor Who. So, Kelvin, this episode, what do you love about Doctor Who?
Well, I found out that in March, I believe it's Titan Comics, they're going to put out a comic book miniseries featuring the Ninth Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
And I was a little surprised to see that because I just kind of assumed there was never going to be any more Ninth Doctor material ever because I just assumed Christopher Eccleston had expressed wishes about that or something.
But they must have disregarded his wishes.
Yeah, I don't know. But apparently there's going to be a Ninth Doctor comic book story coming out in March. And I must confess, I'm very ignorant of the Doctor Who comics. I don't think I've read any of them except for the ones Marvel reprinted like way back in the mid-80s. The ones that Dave Gibbons drew.
Yeah, well, we can probably remedy this at some point
sure.
in the future.
Yeah, I was just really excited because, like, one of my bigger disappointments in Doctor Who as a whole was that we only got one season of the Ninth Doctor.
Right.
I'm excited to see this comic book series.
I'm excited, and I'm excited that you're excited.
That's doubly excited.
Woo-hoo! Josh?
Well, so Christmas night, when the credits rolled on last Christmas and the title for Series 9 opening episode flashed across the screen, The Magician's Apprentice, I, like many other sad fanboys, immediately leapt to the conclusion that this could only mean one thing. Finally, the sequel/prequel to the 1989 classic Battlefield. And I was super excited. But I've gone online and read that a lot of people think this is far-fetched and delusional and based entirely on the word magician being in the title and nothing else. So I guess my temporal grace is just ask that the internet extend some temporal grace toward me and let me live in my sad little world where I believe that The Magician's Apprentice is going to be the sequel prequel to Battlefield. I know it's far-fetched. I know it's stupid. It's like thinking Last Christmas was going to somehow reunite Wham. but I think if the image of a pissed-off Peter Capaldi as Merlin is what keeps me warm during the long winter months, I don't think that's a bad thing, guys.
Well, Josh, you're in a safe space here.
Because it's going to happen.
Yes.
It's going to happen.
It is, Josh. So for me, my temporal grace this week is stock footage. I was watching The Power of Krull again yesterday. Well, I don't want to give away the big reveal, but Doctor Who, of course, is full of great stock footage. The ones that come to mind are the volcanoes at the beginning credits of Inferno that in countless B-movies from this period. Also, the guns going off in the opening credits of the War Games. Boom, 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 boom.
Oh, yeah.
You see that in a lot of kind of period war films from here. But what really got me when watching The Power of Krull is that they're is a scene of clouds rushing past. It's just a shot of the sky that is clearly the same shots of the clouds rushing past that are in the opening credits of The Prisoner.
Oh, wow.
Bum, 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 bum.
That's a sharp eye.
Well, it's only because it's in the opening of every episode of The Prisoner,
yeah.
And those credits are like 25 minutes long, and so you see it all the time. I could be possibly wrong about this, but this is a safe magic circle, and I'm not.
I accept that.
And that's my temporal grace. Stock footage.
Okay, now it's time for round two, Special Topics Dalek. Today, Josh is going to surprise us with an unexpected discussion topic.
All right, guys. Imagine you just won a Doctor Who contest, and the grand prize was the power to temporarily kick Moffat out of his chair and produce your very own one-shot Doctor Who special. You can choose the storyline, scriptwriter, characters, actors, directors, everything. My only stipulation is that you are trapped in 2015 and can only hire living people. Tell me about your very special Doctor Who story.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God, Josh.
I, of course, came up with a question, so I already have an answer. And while you think, I could tell you about mine.
Wow, I don't know, man. Yeah, okay.
Well, of course, if you'd asked me a couple months ago, I would have said a sequel prequel to Battlefield. But now I know that's going to happen, so I don't have to waste my prize on it. So mine would be a Time War story, tentatively titled The Once and Future Apocalypse Now. The Time Lords would send the Doctor, and this is going to be the War Doctor, to find the recently resurrected Rassilon, who has refused to participate in the war and is hiding on the third moon of Delta Magna. Got a lot of crawl on my mind right now. He's gone native and declared himself King of the Swampies. Rassilon here would be played by Dame Judi Dench. This is my dream world. The Doctor reluctantly agrees to go, but discovers too late that the Time Lords have also sent additional help in the form of the Derek Jacobi Master, along with all the morally bankrupt Time Lords who sought immortality from Rassilon, also resurrected, including Barusa, played here by David Bowie, if I were God. The story would feature Barusa sacrificing himself in some way to save Rassilon, redeeming Barusa in the eyes of the Doctor. But unfortunately, the Doctor's hope for Rassilon bringing about a peaceful resolution of the Time War is dashed when the Master kills crazy but benign Judi Dench Rassilon, and using elixirs stolen from the Sisterhood of Karn, regenerates her into fierce warmongering Timothy Dalton Rassilon. And because this is so fan-wanky, I would hire Mark Platt, who is the king of the Big Finish audios, turning fan-wanky pitches into glorious scripts. And because I'd want David Bowie to be comfortable, I would probably get Duncan Jones to direct it. So and music by Howard Shore. That would be my Nice. Oh, and then they'd also introduce K-9, which had been rebuilt by the War Doctor to look like a massive tank with like a nose cannon. And the Master would have to say, I love
special
the smell.
Special weapons.
K-9. Yes, special weapons. And the Master would have to say, I love the smell of Artron energy in the morning at one point. Then I would step back. Everyone else have their
Just these few niggling details.
Provide that brief. Well, I understand why you wanted to go first here, Josh.
Darn
Among
impressive.
Other things, you've hit many of the high points of, including David Bowie, was a coup de theater.
Yes.
I'm going to find that hard to top. So I will just revise your script.
Do it.
A little bit. So first, no Kroll, no Sisterhood of Karn. We've been there. We've done Kroll. Okay, Judi Dench is fine. David Bowie as Barusa is inspired, sir. Inspired. I could do that. But I think it's a crossover between the War Doctor and the Christopher Eccleston Doctor. You can finally work out the issues left over from Day of the Doctor that were not resolved. And instead of Mark Platt, it clearly has to be written by Alan Moore. Because he is the king of being able to take pre-existing bits and pieces of continuity and seamlessly integrate them into a whole and then take a new and completely unexpected perspective on that. And instead of taking place on the third moon of Delta Magna, it takes place...
The second moon, right?
Instead of taking place on the third moon of Delta Magna, it takes place in Britain in the 1950s, and they cross over with Quatermass and his British rocket group, and they bring that explicitly into continuity. It's been mentioned several times, but now they can finally resolve that. Can have to do with the Time War if you want. It can have special weapons K-9 if you care to.
Yes.
And the novelization and inevitable spin-offs will be written by Lance Parkin.
Yes.
And unofficially by Lawrence Miles. But unfortunately, nobody will read those. Kelvin?
Oh, my God.
You're stymied.
God, I don't even know.
When in doubt, cross over with some other media property.
Maybe if there was, like, for no particular reason, it's just suddenly an animated episode and it's done by the people who do Archer.
We're on board already.
Okay. And I would like to see the Doctor doing a story set during the Hundred Years' War, just because that's, like, the biggest English history event I can think of that the Doctor hasn't been to yet for some reason.
And there's a lot of it.
You could do it in real time, like 24. A 100 years.
Yeah, the Doctor covers the 100 Years' War, animated by the people who do Archer.
Which Doctor?
I would do the second then.
So you would have someone else playing Patrick Troughton?
Yeah.
Like one of his actor sons, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay. Advising a succession of English kings in the Hundred Years' War?
Who keep dying from wacky, stupid, archery, violent sort of ways.
As Henry V famously did.
Yeah.
It was really wacky. But sad for England. I think this could work.
I think so. I hope the powers that be are listening. And now round three, the randomizer. In this round, we discuss a randomly selected Doctor Who story. And today, we are talking about the power of Krall.
Krall! 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 Krall!
I'm not going to stop you.
Krall!
Yes!
Krall! Krall?
You're worried about this one running short. No more worries now. Now, in case anyone out there listening doesn't know, the Power of Krall was part of the Key to Time series, in which the Doctor and Romana were in desperate search for all these segments of the Key to Time. And this was written by Robert Holmes, I guess kind of at the last minute, according to what I read, to replace a story with an equally unpromising title, The Shield of Zarek. And Holmes was tasked to create a monster of epic proportions because, you know, somebody thought, hey, you know what, Doctor Who needs? More unconvincing monsters. K-9 obviously did not work on the swampy terrain, but at the last minute, John Leeson, who does the voice of K-9, stepped in to play the role of bleeding heart swampy lover, Dagheen, who's eventually shot dead. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorite things is if you watch very carefully in part four, you can see John Leeson move slightly in the background after he's been shot dead, which I only point out because I think it's ironic that the guy who's famous for playing a dog can't roll over and play dead. Philip Maddock appears again, who's been in a lot of Doctor Who, the Crotons, the War Games, the Brain of Morbius, and I think this is his last appearance. So guys, what do we like about the Power of Krall, which is generally not held in high regard?
No, it's not generally held in high regard.
Fandom.
I like the setting of it. It's in a swamp. And I thought that was like kind of an interesting location in a dull sort of way. I mean, you know, it's just like, oh, here's just expanses of reeds.
Everything outside is pretty good.
Yeah.
It's when you get the interior sets that things start to go very shaky.
Terrible sets.
I had read, whether it's true or not, that the head of the BBC hated these sets and that the gentleman who did them was fired and never worked again, retroactively making the Doctor's comments when he's taken into the execution room about the architecture and how poor it was. A little ironic.
And it is pretty egregious, even by Doctor Who standards, even discounting the wobbly ladders and things like that. The counter, the countdown timer that you see in the very last few minutes of the episode, they couldn't even get the edges of the corrugated steel around it correct. There, it's been clearly cut out with a jigsaw or something, and it hasn't been smooth. There's nothing. Oh, it's the worst.
It is pretty bad.
So we agree it is not the best looking Doctor Who story.
You know, yeah, but it's not consistently awful. I personally like the design of Krall itself.
Yeah.
I think it's really gross. It's unusually yucky for Doctor Who.
It looks
like a slime monster.
It's pure Lovecraftian.
It is.
Giant.
And the tentacles spilling out of holes is really unpleasant.
Yeah, what most people don't seem to like, and I see why, is the extremely sharp delineation of the color separation overlay, where you see Kroll rising above the swamp,
yeah,
and then there's this really sharp line that divides.
And it cuts off some of the swampy's heads.
Yeah, and so that's poorly done. Nobody, it's indefensible, but the design of the monster itself is pretty good.
The design of the monster.
Frankly, even like the swampy design, mostly because of their braided hair.
Yeah, that was a reasonably good attempt at dealing with a... shall we call it a racially insensitive era?
There is a lot of racial stuff that we can talk about. Maybe we'll get deeper in the weeds, as it were, later on.
But the weeds of Delta Magnus.
It's kind of like they invented a whole new sort of racism for this episode.
It was not subtle by any means.
No.
However, you can see in the script that Holmes' issues are with figures of authority.
Yeah.
Thawne is the most racist of the miners.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
The most bloodthirsty. And he comes to a terrible end. He gets speared, which again is pretty graphic for Doctor Who. But then also, Holmes in the script has no love for the High Priest or the Swampies either.
He's clearly portrayed as like just a fraud. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm being a little unfair. It's not like this is unreflectively racist in the way that some other Doctor Who stuff is, and even maybe Talons of Wang Chiang and other Bob Holmes script that isn't very ironic about its racism. Here, it's at the center of what the story is. It's a critique of colonialism.
Yeah.
It's kind of a colonialist mashup, because you have Rome Dutt, who has kind of an Indian-sounding name, but has an Irish accent. The natives themselves are reminiscent of American Indians. So it's kind of like the history of Earth colonialism squished together onto this tiny planet.
It falls apart a little in that he's seemingly critiquing the miners' racism, but he spends no time portraying the Swampies in any other way but a stereotypical primitive race. So he doesn't give them much of a culture, and what he does is a glaring stereotype.
There's one thing in this story that I noticed this time around. The Swampies apparently were natives of the main planet, Delta Magna,
yep,
who had been displaced by this company centuries earlier and then moved to this, like, swampy moon.
So it's like a reservation.
Like a reservation-type situation. And now the company is moving into the moon. You know, and there's hints in it that the Swampies, God, I hate calling them that. I wish they were...
They didn't give them other names.
Yeah, why didn't you give them, like, a real... The people never named themselves. They're just Swampies. But there's indications that the Swampies had a more technologically advanced culture or something when they lived on the main planet. Like the architecture of the torture chamber thing. Supposedly that was brought with them from the planet. The book that had the writings of Kroll was apparently from the planet, and they don't apparently have any system of writing or preserving written communication at all anymore. You know, maybe that's a thing.
You have to stretch and fill a lot in. I think the issue is, if you're going to critique racism yet portray the minority race in question with stereotypes and broad strokes, that's where some of it falls apart. And it's not just there, so I don't know that it's fair to just say Holmes is being racist here. I think he's being lazy. I think he filled in, because a lot of things that you expect from Holmes here are kind of lax. There's a lot of sloppy exposition. I mean, they essentially just find a hole, the Doctor and Romana, jump down it, come up with a book of exposition. And it's really funny, clever, charming dialogue between them as they read the book of exposition, but it's really Holmes just sort of shrugging his way through this script.
Yeah, it doesn't absolve the racism or anything, but I just thought it was kind of interesting that the Swampies had more of a society, and because of the company moving in, they're kind of really don't have anything. I mean, it's about as Stone Age a society as I've ever seen portrayed.
Yeah, it suggests a lot of interesting ideas without really developing them very far, which is the case with a lot of Doctor Who.
Well, yeah.
But with something as kind of racially
charged
as this.
The thing is, on the surface, it's still far more entertaining to watch than I remember it being. I probably haven't seen this in 15 years, and there's still a lot of really funny dialogue in here.
A sort of book of holy writ. It's atrociously writ, but the pictures aren't bad.
That's like a Marx Brothers routine between the two of them. It's very funny. It also has probably one of my favorite resolutions to a cliffhanger. the end of episode one, where Romana is being menaced by the unconvincing monster. Mm. And then we cut to the beginning of episode two.
There's a reason it's an unconvincing monster.
The resolution is it's actually an unconvincing monster, a man in an unconvincing monster suit. And I don't know that they've done that meta joke before in Doctor Who. The Doctor even comforts Romana by saying, I'm sure it was more convincing from the front.
So, you know, I dig that joke too. I think it's very funny. But within the context of this Graham Williams era of Doctor Who, with Douglas Adams doing a lot of the script stuff, it gets a bit much for me. There are a lot of jokes at the expense of what Doctor Who is, just for the sake of having a cheap joke. Another example here would be the very, very end where they're like doing the usual Doctor Who, goodbye, okay, mm-hmm. I guess everything's fine now, and we're gonna take off, or we're gonna go to a different planet. And there's a scene, Philip Maddox's character is left in the room all alone, except for a ton of swampies there. He spent the entire four episodes with his pals trying to kill him. And so as soon as the Doctor and Romana leave, they all turn to look at him in this menacing way. And he has this frightened expression on his face. And then it cuts. Like, are they going to kill this poor son of a bitch? It's like, well, I would hope not. But this is the kind of joke. It's like, it's funny, but it's just kind of not in the spirit of it. We can be funny because we're just playing around with Doctor Who and none of it matters.
Yeah. I think in another season or so in the Graham Williams era, everyone's on the same page, and so the stories are more cohesive in this style, like Horns of Nemon. Here, I think part of the problem is the Doctor and Romana are just playing this as a lark, mm-hmm. and then some of the actors are also kind of trying to play it really straight. Some of the swampies are totally committed to being swampies, mm-hmm. and no one can really decide, is it a satire? Is it melodrama?
Kroll! Kroll! So yeah, I've seen The Power of Kroll an unusual number of times.
Yeah.
Watched it, growing up at least once or twice. I watched it at the Key to Time party at your house years ago.
The whole overall Key to Time season seems to be kind of a go-to thing for a lot of people our age.
Watched the whole thing when I got the first DVD set.
Yeah.
And then I got the DVD set that had the extras on it. And then I just rewatched it for this. So I may have seen Kroll more than I've seen any other classic Doctor Who.
Which is unfortunate.
I could bear to not watch it again. But having said that, I don't think it's terrible. And I don't hate it the way a lot of fandom does. I like a lot of the dialogue, like you say. I like Kroll itself. I like the Doctor and Romana farting around, even though Mary Tam doesn't have anything to do. And I like
the exterior. She does nothing. She does not do one effective thing in the entire story.
I was thinking about this. Is the first Romana, like the first companion the Doctor has ever had who just kind of doesn't put up with his crap?
Companions call him on things depending on the situation. But yeah, she's
But I mean, the first Romana like really seems to like have kind of an almost eye-rolling quality whenever the Doctor does anything doctorish.
Sometimes I don't think you're right in the head.
Yeah.
Exactly. She's diagnosing him with some sort of space psychology degree she has. I can't remember what her credentials are from Gallifrey.
Well, like supposedly she did better in school than the Doctor did or something.
So what do you guys think about the high-pitched scream? That's the other thing that gets this story a lot of flack.
Oh,
he breaks the window.
That's the worst. It's so stupid, and it's the reason that this show will never be taken seriously. I had an English professor in high school who was a big Anglophile, and we would get along very well on things like Shakespeare and BBC television in general, but he could not stand Doctor Who because for him it was nothing but high-quality, talented British actors in, like, the worst garbage imaginable, right? And, you know, I would periodically try to be like, oh, look, you know, this thing isn't so bad and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, you could never show someone like that this.
No.
And it's like, what, is this for infants? Yeah, that's so dumb. You know, and it's too bad, too, because so much of it, Robert Holmes's dialogue and the interesting kind of racial swamp that everything is occurring is interesting.
That was another thing that reminded me, like another kind of weirdly racial comment. The Doctor initially tries to get out of that torture thing by hypnotizing one of the swampies, mm-hmm. and he said he couldn't because it had those narrow eyes.
That one that went really, right past me.
That really kind of jumped out at me and like went, what?
I'd have to revisit it. I thought it was because of the narrowness of the vision that the religious zealotry was involved in. But knowing that this is also from the writer of Talons of Wang Chiang, I won't discount it entirely.
It's a nice retcon, but I don't buy it.
It still has a couple of those little enjoyable moments. I think when Fenner says, you know, I could do without those sons of Earth, just the way he delivers sons of Earth, those dirty sons of Earth. It's very easy to watch, unless you're Pat, who's watched it 63 times. There are also some interesting things watching it after the new series, in that it feels like Tom Baker's approach to the Doctor in this era, and I saw a lot of it in this episode, where he comes in and starts babbling incessantly, talking about something that appears as if he's coming at the problem from a weird angle, and then it comes around and it's important, like the architecture in the execution room mm-hmm. that he's rambling about, but it comes down to the window, and that's what's going to actually save them. It's very much new series Doctors, that sort of bantering, nonsensical idiot talk.
It's fertile ground for a potential sequel, too. The new series could do something on the main planet very easily, because they've established, there's the Sons of Earth there. We know it's overcrowded. They have this type of political structure. What happens when they don't get their protein from
the refinery thing?
Are there going to be food riots? And, of course, what happens when the idea of this potential genocide on the Swampies comes to light? There could be a great political follow-up story to this. Probably more interesting than the story that was actually broadcast.
Yeah.
There's a great Capaldi-esque moment of utter callousness on Tom Baker's part, where I guess it should be reversed. Peter Capaldi's having some Tom Baker moments, but when the gunrunner gets grabbed and just outright eaten by Krall, the Doctor's like, oh, told him not to run.
Yeah.
And he could care less. And Romana even says it's horrific. And he's just like, eh.
Yeah. Irish gunrunner with a weird name. Who cares?
Who cares? He had narrow eyes. Eat him.
God. I do like the duck lapel pins the Doctor wears.
We're really reaching now.
Yeah. Yes.
I think in the end, any story with a hovercraft can't be all bad.
Yeah, hovercraft's cool. I'm pro hovercraft.
Krall!
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 All right, Krall.
Josh, I hear you have something for this week's wonderful afunctionalism.
I sure do. I was driving around and stuck in traffic with my kids, and I was trying to come up with this episode's special topic, and trying to be a good dad. I tried to involve them in things like Doctor Who podcasts, and I asked my daughter, who's 10 years old, if she had some ideas for questions, and they were all really not very good for special topics, but I thought they might be interesting in a wonderful afunctionalism. So I'm going to throw out a couple of these questions to you guys and see if you can answer them. Pat,
yes.
Does the Doctor like cheese? And if so, what kind?
Oh, well, I've given a lot of thought to this. And I think that the Doctor probably does like cheese, unilaterally and without reservation. Having said that, he probably has some favorites. He probably likes English cheeses and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Stilton. Gloucester.
All those things that Wallace and Gromit talk about.
Wensleydale.
We do have some canonical evidence. We know that John Pertwee enjoyed some Gorgonzola.
Gorgonzola. Wow. Sounds like a Smurf villain. But I think certainly Sylvester McCoy would appreciate Camembert. Something where he could roll his R's in a way that I can't.
Kelvin, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Which Doctor had the best pants?
The best pants?
Yeah, that's another question from my daughter.
Oh, that's a good one.
I just like that I've forced you to imagine.
Yeah, probably the 5th or the 6th, actually.
You're a stripe man.
Yeah, the stripes, I think, are cool. I do appreciate the 2nd Doctor's plaid, because that's a bold choice. But I think the 6th Doctor with the stripes and the spat combo, maybe it's more the footwear.
The footwear informs the pants.
But yeah, the stripes I think are nice and daring, and he can pull it off.
And finally, my daughter really wants to know, why are we even doing this podcast?
Well, I thought it would be easy. I thought it would require no effort at on my part whatsoever. I thought I would just show up, maybe have a refreshing pint of Guinness, and I would just blather on and on about all the time I'd wasted in my youth watching this show.
Well, thank you. I think that is actually the lesson my daughter most needs to learn. You heard it from Calvin. Pat?
Why are we doing this? For the fans. Now shut your mouth, Miriam.
Now do your homework.
That's never going to happen. And now for our fifth and final round, the Death Zone. In this round, we pair two or more Doctor Who stories or characters from any medium or period in the show's history and see how they stack up against each other. Today, we will be talking about the Big Finish audio Jubilee, featuring the Sixth Doctor, Colin Baker, and Dalek, the Ninth Doctor story that reintroduced Daleks to the revitalized series. And this is a little different because Jubilee and Dalek are written by the same person, Rob Shearman, and Dalek is a rewrite of Jubilee, at least in its most basic concept.
Right.
And Jubilee came out in 2003, two whole years before the new series hit our screens. And I have read that Jubilee was used by Russell T. Davies to pitch how he would sell Daleks to a 21st century audience. So let's start by tackling Jubilee.
I largely liked Jubilee. I think I've got some definite problems with the plot, but it's a pretty unsettling story. Startlingly unsettling. I mean, like, wow, I didn't think it was going to go there.
Well, you're right, Kelvin. There's a lot of stuff in Jubilee that you couldn't get away with on the new series now.
Oh, no.
Including just slapping your wife. That happens in episode one, and I was
For no reason.
Well, I think it's thematically.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's to establish that Rochester is horrible.
Yeah, that by itself would not be something you would see in the new series. Things like heads on pikes, you'll probably not see in the new series.
Probably not see a double amputee doctor.
Nope. And you certainly wouldn't see them drinking Dalek juice.
That was super weird.
Excretion from the Dalek.
That was, like, crazy bizarre.
These are, like, the really outrageously over-the-top things about Jubilee, but I think I might like it more than you do, Kelvin. For me, this is some of the best writing that Doctor Who has. I think it's extremely complex. It's too much. There's too many concepts, and they kind of trip over each other every now and then, so I'll grant you that. And there's a little bit too much metafictionality, where it's playing with the fact that it's fictional.
Like fans of the Daleks.
Yeah, there's that really on-the-nose Dalek mania parody where, oh, you slap a Dalek on anything and it sells 100 times more copies, which I find funny, but it's a bit on-the-nose and it's maybe the joke is a little worn out by now. But having said that, just the sharpness of the writing, I think, is something to admire. It's an audio play, so he can't get away with prose description. He can't get away with action occurring on the screen, so everything has to happen in dialogue between the characters. Mm-hmm. And it's consistently entertaining.
Yeah.
It's intelligent without being pompous. And it delivers the story, a constantly surprising story, so you never really know where it's going. A few things that are maybe underwhelming at the end, the whole timey-wimey alternate universe thing kind of peters out at the end. I don't know that it's effective.
That was kind of my big reservation about it, was something weird happens with the TARDIS and it tries to go to two points in time simultaneously, which results in the Doctor fighting the Daleks in an earlier era, which creates a huge time paradox and an alternate timeline and all this stuff.
Simple. I get it.
But they never explain why that happened.
Why did
the TARDIS go to two different places like that? Because it had to. I kept waiting for, like, oh, the Daleks were trying this thing, you know, some kind of time experiment, and the TARDIS crashed into it or something. But they never explain why that happened.
I guess I don't require a pseudoscientific explanation for why it happened because it's just hand-wavy. You know, these things happen in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
It's in service to the themes.
There's two narrative reasons for it. Yeah. One, because they need to have an alternate universe English Empire 100 years later. And then they need to undo that, but have the the lingering memory of all of this evil empire exist in the real world. Mm-hmm. Because when everything is undone, the 1903 characters still retain the memory of all of the horror that had happened, and this is what leads into our real 20th century and presumably underlies a lot of the world wars and other horrors that are happening in the 20th century. And that's where I think the thematics start to disintegrate a little bit, because Rob Sherman, I think, had that clearly in mind right from the beginning, but didn't signpost it or establish it as effectively as he could.
Yeah, themes are great, but when you just kind of, the plot just suddenly disintegrates into, well, that just happened. I don't know.
But the themes aren't even really the center of Jubilee. It's the new idea of what a Dalek is. And that's where it really shines. Mm-hmm.
It is both new, but at the same time, what I like about it is it's a 21st century take on the original Dalek Terry Nation idea of this Nazi stand-in, but updating it and taking it to this sort of nth degree and looking backwards at that at the same time.
Well, when I mentioned Alan Moore earlier, this is the kind of thing that I had in mind. Rob Sherman does it here. He takes something that's implicit in Doctor Who, in this case, the character of the Daleks, what they are and how they operate, but had never been thematized or pushed to the extreme up to then. He takes the original Terry Nation conception, a Dalek is a thing that follows orders and kills, and strips it of the ability to do that, and then forces it to make decisions on its own. It's wonderful, all the complexity of how that plays out. It keeps asking people, give me orders, what do I do?
It leads to one of my favorite Doctor Who cliffhangers in any medium, because again, it's something that I think only Doctor Who would do. It's, I think, the end of part three. They're on their way to the big Jubilee celebrations, and the Dalek essentially says, we have nothing but choices. I'm finally beginning to realize that. I will either go and be executed or get my revenge. And then in comes the Sting. And so essentially we have free will as a cliffhanger. And I think only in Doctor Who would that happen.
And one of the things I love so much about Jubilee is that the motivations of the Dalek are so complex. They're much more complex than they are in the Russell Davies episode, which we'll get to. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Dalek in Jubilee, it doesn't seem to know why it saves Evelyn. It agonizes over the idea of choice, but it doesn't have sentimentality to it. And eventually it goes into a paradoxical realm where it's going to destroy the entire Dalek race in order to save it, because it's been trapped into this logical loop that we can only win if we lose. Its exchange with the Dalek Supreme Leader is my favorite part of the entire four episodes. It's trying to explain how it came to all of these conclusions, but I think I may be insane. Just both hilarious and heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah.
The Dalek trying to figure it out is some of the most compelling stuff. And he gives several different reasons throughout of to why he feels some kinship to Evelyn.
Because she's a soldier?
That was interesting too, all that stuff. Because she's a soldier, and the Dalek identifies the Doctor as the officer. He's who he would go for orders, which connects back up with our recent season of Peter Capaldi's Doctor.
Yeah.
But he's also feels a kinship with Evelyn because she is frightened, and no one else is frightened of him anymore. He later says that he has respect, but so it's just all, it's very compelling, and even the idea of Dalek respect is compelling.
Wonderful stuff. Well, we should get to talking about the RTD episode too, but before we move on, I have to mention the Doctor's wonderful speech to the assembled masses at the end as they're baying for the Dalek's blood. It's maybe a little didactic, a little bit on the nose, but he talks about a race that was bred for conquest and all it could care about was power and conquest. And that's the Daleks. And what's your excuse? You're so much worse talking to human beings. You've brought yourself to this point out of choice. Mm-hmm. It's that free choice thing again. This is really the reverse of the wonderful Ark in Space monologue,
speech,
the soliloquy
yes.
where he says how wonderful humanity is. Here's the Colin Baker Doctor. It is absolutely darkest, is least forgiving, and it's terrific stuff.
As a bit of a segue into talking about Dalek, one of the things that really impressed me re-listening to Jubilee again after we've had 10 years of the new series, this came out in 2003, and how much this touches on stuff from the new series, whether it be the soldier material. There's a lot from Into the Dalek in that very last episode where it's a doctor being convinced there's nothing good about the Dalek and it couldn't change, and Evelyn chiding him and the Dalek surprising him at the end, but the Dalek still changing but still being at its core a Dalek, because it does good to give glory to the Daleks and kill all the Daleks. And that's very much something out of the new series.
Well, this is a fruitful way to talk about what does the episode Dalek do on its own terms, and what does it take from Jubilee, and what does it anticipate in terms of what the series is going to be. When it was broadcast, I fooled myself for a short while thinking, this is really the last Dalek story. This would make a perfect end to however many decades of Dalek stories. This would form a suitable ending for it. Of course, in retrospect, you don't bring the Daleks back for one story like this and have a kind of character drama. You bring them back to show off the new capacities of the Dalek, that they can hover, that they can absorb the entire internet into their brain in a few moments, that they can kill a man with their plunger, that if it were let free, the entire planet would be exterminated because of one Dalek. So you're setting the stakes of what these new Daleks can do, so that in a few episodes when you bring them back, you're like, oh, wow, those new Daleks. I saw what one of them could do.
This is what one Dalek can do. Yeah. Dalek watching again reminded me a lot of the fake Doctor Who trailer at the top of Jubilee, where they're talking more action, more excitement, more Daleks getting killed. And there's parts of Dalek that seem to be at odds with each other, where it does want to be a awesome, that Dalek kicks ass story, and a sort of thoughtful character study of the Doctor and the Dalek.
It's gone so far removed from its Jubilee roots
that
a lot of the things that it takes from Jubilee, it does either perfunctorily or the reverse. Do you fear me? Comes up in both, but that's one of those things that is explicitly reversed.
Exactly.
Evelyn persistently says, yes, I'm afraid of you, as any right-thinking person should. But Rose, who has not met the Daleks before, says that she isn't. And this leads into the whole new sentimental approach to the Dalek, where ultimately the Dalek wants its freedom.
Whereas in Jubilee, it's terrified of its freedom.
Right, it wants orders.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Dalek in Dalek starts by saying that too. It starts by saying, I need orders, and ends by saying, I need freedom. And sunlight, apparently, too.
Well, because he's been touched by Rose, which I think is a very big difference there. It is that sort of sci-fi trope waving away the Dalek's transformation. They didn't want to commit to finding too much character growth or room in the idea of a Dalek, so they had to sort of say the introspection that the Dalek goes through is because of he's got Rose DNA or human DNA.
And they don't have as much time.
No, they do not.
They have a lot more to do in 40 minutes.
Can anyone explain to me why Dalek was set in the near future?
Sci-fi elbow room? That would be all I could think of.
I think it has
to do... Yeah, but they don't really use any particular sci-fi elbow room, though.
I think it has a little bit to do with the American-ness of it. Van Staten is conspicuously American.
Conspicuously American.
And making fun of the president. And so I think the idea of this underground collector who has all these alien invasion artifacts.
You know,
it would have to be American and maybe has to be 5 minutes in the future.
You know, in the modern era, Doctor Who has visited America, I believe, 4 times. And 2 of those times are in Utah.
Nice scenery.
I don't know why that stuck in my mind.
Before we wrap it up, I want to make sure that we get to 2 important scenes, I think, that both texts share but are done completely differently. The first one is, in both stories, the Doctor is tossed into a dark room where the imprisoned Dalek is, and then it's revealed, it's a Dalek, and the Dalek freaks out, kill the Doctor, recognizes him on sight, tries to kill him, can't in either case. In both cases, the Doctor, wah! And Chris Eccleston does a terrific job with this, where he just freaks the hell out.
Well, obviously, the case of Dalek, you've got so much baggage of the Time War.
Yeah.
So there's added content to his response to the Dalek, even though it's ostensibly the same scene in both.
But what
stories.
Happens next is interesting. It's for exactly that reason, because where Colin Baker turns into curious and compassionate to a degree, not really compassionate, but he doesn't like seeing anything tied up and tortured. Christopher Eccleston goes gleeful immediately.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, oh, you can't do anything. What's a Dalek if it can't kill? You know, he starts taunting it right to its face. And this is part of that whole project of setting up Doctor Who for the 21st century. Who is the Doctor now? What kind of character is he? Mm-hmm. So we see him establishing his new character in a slightly sadistic way against something that is familiar, in this case, a Dalek, which we have our childhood affection for.
And it has to be the most crazed we've ever seen the Doctor portrayed up to that point, and since, really, where there's no mind control, there's no post-regenerative trauma. That is just post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's a really brilliant scene, and I think it was a pretty brave performance. They played a lot of stuff safe in the new series reboot, but that really, really wasn't to let Eccleston just go full bore and spit and pull that lever to kill it over and over again and have to be dragged off of it. Mm-hmm. They just weren't fooling around. And it's classic Shearman, that sort of sadism is this underlying theme in a lot of his work, too.
And it's a good bookend for the other scene that I wanted to talk about, where in Dalek, the Dalek asks the Doctor, "Give me orders, what should I do?" And Eccleston says, "Kill yourself." Flat out just says that. The same scene in Jubilee is when the old legless Doctor is asked by the Dalek, "What do I do? Give me orders." And the Colin Baker Doctor refuses and refuses and refuses to give orders to the Dalek, up to the point where he's murdered by him. That kind of speaks very much to the fundamental difference in thematics between the two stories. One is about the terror of choice, and one is about establishing the characters, the Doctor, his companion, and what the Daleks are going to be like in the new series. So what's it going to be, Calvin? Final thoughts on this pairing?
I really do have to give it to Jubilee.
Despite your reservations?
I had the plot issue with Jubilee, but I still think it's, on the whole, more impressive.
Yeah, I'm with you. I thought this was going to be a harder decision, because when I saw Dalek when the new series started, I liked it a lot. I still like it, but it's much weaker than I remember it. Part of it is being superseded by better stories, more consistently told. But most of it is, I think, that Jubilee is just fundamentally better. It's more ambitious, and it's better pulled off. So it's Jubilee all the way for me.
Hands down, Jubilee. I have nothing more to add that you haven't said.
Final thing on Jubilee. We didn't mention that Rochester was played by Martin Jarvis,
who
loved in Vengeance on Varos a few episodes
and
back.
And he was so good in Vengeance on Varos, too. Yeah.
Shout out to him here.
All the actors, the actress who played Miriam is fantastic. Just oozes insanity.
Evelyn. And, of course, the Dalek going for the Oscar.
The Oscar will go to the Dalek race.
I would like to thank the Daleks. And the Daleks!
And Angelina Jolie. That's our show. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Tony Karna, for recording all of this.
Yay.
Listeners, if you enjoyed it, please tell all your geeky friends, and also join us next time. We'll be welcoming a very special guest, the man behind our theme song, Pablo Jones. We'll be discussing the Peter Davison story, as selected by the randomizer, Frontios, and in the Death Zone, Captain Jack Harkness versus Vizlor Turlo. Until next time, fellas, I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Josh.
And we're saying,
get off my world!
While we're talking, I'm going to eat nuts at you.
It won't be the first time.
Oh, snap. You sit there and drink your kombucha.
Look at you people and your fancy-ass beverages. Juice.
You want a beer,
kombucha.
Calvin?
Kombucha. If I have another beer, I'll just fall asleep.